Let's begin. It's already 9:01. Today is March 4th. I just want to respond to a couple comments and then we're going to get right into it. I don't think I can finish today, so we'll go to next class. And hopefully by then people will realize that we're back. Just a couple comments. Moshe from Lakewood emailed me. We were talking a lot last class about what the Aruch HaShulchan said, loyalty to the Tsar, etc. So Moshe emails that in his drashot, which were recently published, Kol Ben Levi, in the first one, there's more materials of him praising the Tsar, etc., preaching against counter-revolutionary activity, the Tsar has protected us from pogroms. And I responded to that I don't think he's speaking here with an eye to the censor. The rabbis did preach loyalty to the Tsar, and they probably did think that the Tsar was protecting them from the pogroms. But that's very different than wanting to serve in the army. When you have the Aruch HaShulchan saying that, we all look forward to serving in the army, that sort of thing, that I think we have to assume is tongue in cheek. Second, we had discussion last class, also Moshe from Lakewood. I use the phrase Malchus Shel Chesed, and he said that Medina Shel Chesed is the more common. I actually Googled it, and Malchus Shel Chesed is much more common. I sent him just something I pulled up from Yateid Naaman, where the Nav Minsker Rebbe at the Aguda convention, I think it was last year, referred to America as a Malchus Shel Chesed, which ties into what I said. I mean, you never see modern Orthodox people speaking. Using that phrase, Malchus Shel Chesed, because that implies a regime outside of us which treats us nicely, as opposed to feeling that you're actually a part of the country and it's not a regime that's giving chesed to you, but you're a part of it. Medina Shel Chesed is also used, but Malchus Shel Chesed is much more. I think I also mispronounced in discussing the. You know, when Aruch HaShulchan, we spoke about his reference to Greeks, removing Greeks from the Hanukkah story, the term, and I spoke about the chronicle of the Chmelnytsky massacres. I think I referred to it as Yavan Metzula. And after class, I realized that that's a mistake. It's not Yavan, it's Yevon. It's the pun. It comes from a pasuk in Tehillim, chapter 69, where it says, Bivan Metzula. But the pun is on the word Yevon and Yavan. And finally, one more thing. Thank you, Bill. Yes, Ramosha used Malchus Shel Chesed. One more thing, and I hope this is not. Actually, two more things. Yossi has something also. Let me say something from Yossi. If this is the Yossi with us, perhaps he mentions that, first of all, he agrees with what I said. About the Aruch HaShulchan really being focused on the Rambam, that's his real interest. But he also mentions that Chabad likes the comment on Hagbah, where he praises the Chabad custom of putting on the mantle only after first rolling the Torah on the bima. If you know Chabad, they lift it up, Hagbah, then they put it down. And then he says, I assume he learned of this Chabad custom from his days in the Chabad town. I don't see where else he would have learned of it. And if he knew it, why would he have mentioned it? The fact that he was in a Chabad town, that obviously I think would have been important. Here, and one final comment, because we're speaking about Russia, I just want to share this with you. Again, I hope that no one considers this disrespectful. I don't think it's disrespectful. I just think it tells us something about, a great rabbi today, but one who never could have said this, I think, if he had more insight into the world, and certainly not if he had been living. If he'd been living somewhere other than Israel, I think. There's a rabbi named Rav Yitzhak Zilberstein. He's the son-in-law of Rav Alyosha and has written many books, commentaries on the Talmud, with all sorts of, you read the commentary on the Talmud, I love reading it, even if I'm not learning the sugya, but I skim through it, because he has all these crazy stories, and I know he makes the stories up. And this is not, I don't think that's a disrespectful point, because I think everyone knows he makes the stories up to, come up with it, just like the Trumas HaDeshen. At least some people hold that the questions in there are not true. Because, like, he has a famous one that Rabbi Bleich spoke about, the poison sandwich, all these crazy this cases about someone who every day his lunch was being taken, was being stolen. So he wanted to know whether he could put poison in the lunch. and some the person who stole it would eat it and then be killed, is he somehow responsible for that because the guy shouldn't have stole it? I mean, all sorts of strange questions which bring up interesting concepts, but there's no way in the world that these stories are true. But they're interesting. But this story is, it's true because it deals with a case and it relates to Russia. And I was shocked when I read it, but let me share it with you. And, you know, we spoke about Russia and what it was like to live in Russia. And certainly I mentioned that the Soviet Union was a lot worse. He was asked as follows. This is, I found this in numerous places. You can see it in his book, Chashukei Chemed, on Masachet Shabbat, page 69b. He has it also in his book, Torah Sayoledes, which is on childbirth. I'm troubled by Rabbi Zilberstein for other reasons as well. I wrote in one of my blog posts how he thought it was okay to censor Moshe Feinstein's opinion. That is, when he quotes it, not quoted accurately, when he was challenged on that, he said, he basically said that he gave a reason why he felt he was able to present a false version of what Ramosha said. It has to do with Ramosha's opinion about a husband being in the childbirth room. And I don't know, I just find that completely unacceptable that you can falsify Ramosha Feinstein's position because you don't like it. And when you not just not mention it, but when you quote it intentionally, quote it falsely. How is that acceptable? I don't know what world that would be acceptable in today. But he's asked the following question. You know, there was in Georgia, in Russia, there was religious Jews there, Sephardic Jews. And this question goes back to the 70s that the rabbi was asked if someone had a chance to escape from Russia, because he can't be a religious Jew in Russia. The example he said, you can't be, he's forced to work on Shabbos. He's a Machal Shabbos. But by him escaping on Shabbos, he would have to escape. As part of the escape, he'd have to violate Shabbos. Then he can make it to America or Israel and be free. And the rabbi, this Rav Emanuel was his name, who apparently was a big Talmud Chacham, I guess their last big Talmud Chacham, he said, absolutely, try to escape. And if you violate Shabbos, it doesn't matter, because then you'll have a chance to observe many more Shabboses. And Rav Zilberstein goes into a whole thing here, how he thinks that's incorrect. Because when you're in Russia, and they force you to violate Shabbos, then you don't have a choice. So you haven't sinned because you're doing what you're supposed to do. Because if you don't violate Shabbos, they'll kill you or whatever they'll do to you. However, when you and therefore you're putter. So you're not really violating Shabbos because you have no choice. But if you choose to run away, then you are willingly violating Shabbos where you have no heter. And that's his conclusion. Kolod ein sakana lefanav, afal pi sheyimat be'avei rot. You know, then you can't do it. Shmami nasha asur l'chal Shabbat. So when you read this, you have to ask yourself, how is it possible for anyone who knows anything about Russia to say this? Does he know what it meant to live in Russia? Where it's not just about not observing Shabbos. You can't be a Jew there. Your children are going to end up completely assimilated. Nothing. We know you're allowed to violate Shabbos to save someone from Shmad. So you have a, you're telling someone that because you're going to violate one Shabbos, instead you're going to live in the Soviet Union, where basically you probably will end up non-religious eventually, your children will end up non-religious, you can't be a Jew there. Now, then he concludes, that's his opinion, but Rav Yoshev, his grandfather, said no, violate Shabbos. But I don't understand how anyone with any sense of what it meant to live in the Soviet Union would say that there's a problem running away from the, if you can save your physical life, certainly you can save your spiritual life, where there's no impossible to be a Jew there. And as I said, he mentions that his Rav Yashav disagreed, but it just, it's I can't even fathom how someone could think that, but except maybe a limud zchus, that a lot of these great rabbis are so cut off from really history and what it meant to live there. Rav Zilberstein is the one who's responsible for this idea. And how do I know this? Because his brother-in-law said this is where he got it from, that non-Jews have a different number of teeth than Jews. Rav Chaim Konevsky is a whole thing. He says his brother-in-law told him, Zilberstein, that non-Jews have a different number of teeth than Jews. And so again, these are things that I find very troubling. Okay, let's pick up with what we're doing. I'll come back to the questions later. Tuvia Preshel devoted a few articles, some of his inaccuracies could be. I have Tuvia Preshel's three volumes, but it's not in that. I think they have a fourth volume now, which is being sent to me from Israel. Okay, returning to the Aruch HaShulchan. So now let's speak about influence and speak about some important halachic decisions. I mentioned, and there's no question about this, that his influence has declined in the last couple of generations. It is true that important figures, a couple of names that I have, include Rav Henkin, Rav Yosef L. Henkin, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, all regarded the Aruch HaShulchan as more authoritative than the Mishnah Berurah, for different reasons, as we'll see. And from everything I've learned, this was not, I wouldn't say the standard perspective, but a standard perspective. I think during the lifetimes, this was a standard perspective, but even afterwards, my sense is that in Lithuania, the Aruch HaShulchan was regarded as more authoritative than the Mishnah Berurah. But that wasn't the case for long. And I've already mentioned how in our own day, we've had the publication of an Aruch HaShulchan with the Pesachim of the Mishnah Berurah. The point being, telling you that the Aruch HaShulchan cannot stand on its own. It's basically only a theoretical work that you study, but not for practical halacha. Just to give you an example, that it's not only before the war. I'm right now putting together my article on the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai. I was at a conference in China earlier this year, and so they just sent us, they want the articles. And I talk about not just the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai, some of the Jewish community in Shanghai. If you haven't been to Shanghai, I highly recommend it. It's from a Jewish, just from a Jewish angle. They wanted me to do a tour there, but that's already too difficult. The food isn't even such a problem. It would take too long and it's complicated, but let me just give you an example. In May 1942, what happened was they needed, once Pearl Harbor happened, they couldn't get Sfarim shipped to them from America. Before Pearl Harbor, Rav Kalmanovitz shipped lots of copies of, they were learning tractate Kiddushin, and he shipped many tractates. But after Pearl Harbor, you couldn't have any direct communication anymore between Shanghai and the United States because it was controlled by Japan, and obviously America was at war with Japan. So they came up with the idea of printing their own works, and they printed a lot. They printed, I wrote a blog post in which I spoke about some of the books they printed. They printed the entire Shas, except for Masachas Yevamos, not sure why not, the Mishnah Torah, medieval and more recent works, including the Mishnah Berurah. So in Shanghai, when they were looking for a halacha work to reprint, they didn't print the Aruch HaShulchan, they reprinted the Mishnah Berurah. And there's famous picture of Aaron Cutler carrying the Mishnah Berurah. He apparently always carried the Mishnah Berurah. So it's not just in the, like in the last generation this changed, but we know that it's been, it really increased the stress given to the Mishnah Berurah. We get a sense, by the way, that the Mishnah Berurah was viewed a little differently just two generations ago because Rav Soloveitchik, for him, he had no difficulty disputing the Mishnah Berurah, as Rav Moshe Feinstein. I mean, they were contemporaries. Not literal contemporaries, but still in the era of the Achronim. Some people have said that the Mishnah Berurah is the end of the Achronim, but it's really not true. It might be today. I don't know if Poskim today will dispute with the Mishnah Berurah. I think perhaps not, but definitely Rav Moshe Feinstein did, Rav Soloveitchik. So you didn't have the sense of the Mishnah Berurah like they had then. But the Aruch HaShulchan today doesn't have that role. I still think, however, and maybe the listeners can disagree with me, I still think that one can use the Aruch HaShulchan as a work of practical halacha, just like one can use the Mishnah Berurah. So I was taught when I was in yeshiva that you can. And I once wrote about an experience I had when I was in high school, when it was in a shir at a shul, and the rabbi was learning the Mishnah Berurah, which is a common thing to be learned. My shul, every Shabbos between Mincha and Ma'ariv, on Shabbos afternoon, there's in one room they have a shul shudas, and in the other room, another rabbi learns Mishnah Berurah. I don't know if you can tell me, is there anywhere where people learn Aruch HaShulchan, but they learn Mishnah Berurah. I was at a shiur learning Mishnah Berurah, and after learning one of the halachot in the Mishnah Berurah, the rabbi pointed out, but we don't hold like this. And that's true. There's plenty of things in the Mishnah Berurah we don't hold like. But a member of the audience asked, if you're learning the Mishnah Berurah by yourself, which of course it's a work you can learn by themselves, How are you supposed to know, when that is the case that we don't hold like it? In other words, if I'm learning the Mishnah Berurah by myself, I see the halacha, I start doing it. How do I know that, quote, we don't hold like it? I'd be doing the wrong thing. And the rabbi replied, that's why it's so important to have a rav, so that you will know when we follow the Mishnah Berurah and when we won't. Now I'm going to tell you what I wrote, and everyone who wrote to me privately from the most right-wing backgrounds agreed with me. So I think I'm right. What I said was as follows, that even though I was quite young when I heard this, even then I thought it was a mistaken reply, and the subsequent years, talking over 30 years, have not changed my mind. Of course, it's important to have a rav, but not for the reason the rabbi said. You need to have a rav for all sorts of reasons. I believe that there's not, and not just I, but not just me, but all the people who wrote to me, there's nothing wrong at all with someone learning the Mishnah Berurah or the Aruch HaShulchan and following everything in it. The notion that the rabbi was expressing that the Mishnah Berurah, even the Mishnah Berurah, is the work that you really can't learn on your own without constantly asking a rabbi, do we follow this or that? One doesn't need this, I wrote, and it would be an impossible task to ask your rav about every halacha or every halacha you think maybe is a problem. Do we follow or do we not follow? Now, obviously, if you live in the Orthodox world, you'll pick up, you'll learn that sometimes the community practice is more strict than what appears in the Mishnah Berurah, and sometimes it's more lenient. And I think in no circumstances it makes sense. If you see that the Mishnah Berurah says one thing, but the minhag, the olam, as they say, is doing something else, then I think it makes sense to ask the rav. Is the fact that we're more lenient, is that than the Mishnah Berurah? Is this some we can rely on this leniency, or should we be more strict? Or if it's the other way around, if the community is more strict than what the Mishnah Berurah, I think then it's appropriate to ask the rav. Do I need to do this because the Mishnah Berurah says you don't have to? Then I think it's appropriate to ask the rav. However, as a general rule, and I've never had any teacher, as far as I know, thought otherwise. One, if one chooses to, one can read either of these texts, and not just these texts, the Chai Adam, Kiddush Shulchan Aruch, whatever it is, and just assume that everything in there is correct, and rely on it as a practical halachic text. We're supposed to be able to read halachic works. That's the whole point of the Chai Adam, the Kiddush Shulchan Aruch, and all these works, even the Shulchan Aruch originally. It was published in a little pocket-sized edition for everyone to carry around. Didn't have all the commentaries. The idea was that anyone who can read the Hebrew is supposed to be able to read it and know what the halacha is. Now, after one of my posts that discussed the Aruch HaShulchan, a member of Rav Moshe Feinstein, actually someone married to a granddaughter of Rav Moshe Feinstein, wrote to me as follows. Quote, I spent a great deal of time learning with and talking to Rav Moshe, both on the east side and in the mountains. He unambiguously told me exactly what you quote from Rav Henkin. He explained that the Aruch HaShulchan was a Rav, while the Mishnah Berurah was a Rosh Yeshiva, and the Psak of a Rav is a better authority. Therefore, when he was unwilling to make his own determination, he would follow the Aruch HaShulchan over the Mishnah Berurah. I mentioned this story to Rav David Zucker, Rosh Kollel of Kollel Zichron Schneir in Chicago, and he told me that he heard the same thing from his Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. So we see that there is a tradition from the old time Lithuanian Rabbanim that the Aruch HaShulchan is preferred, precisely because he's a communal Rav. So I guess his psukim are not as theoretical, you could say, they're more practical. Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin also wrote to me about what I wrote in the Svarim blog. And I received a number of emails from Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, the father of Eitam Henkin. I'm told that he is not well now, and it's not so easy to have conversations with him. In fact, he was on this show, this David Lichtenstein headline show, about 6 months ago. I listen sometimes in my car, I get the podcasts, and you heard Rabbi Henkin, and you couldn't understand what he was saying. It was incomprehensible, and I wrote to Lichtenstein afterwards and said, I'm surprised no one told you that you can't really have conversations with him. I was told by someone in person you could have conversations, but it was very sad to hear, really this great posek, who is not an old man by any means, but is really not able to provide guidance and communicate coherently anymore. But he wrote to me This is 10 years ago. So it's a big honor that a great post like this was reading the Sorian blog. But he wrote to me, he wrote a number of things about this issue of the Mishnah Berurah versus the Aruch Shulchan. And he says that people quote the Chazon Ish as saying that the Mishnah Berurah is like the Sanhedrin. And I think he wrote that. He wrote that in one of his letters. He says that the Chazon Ish says that the Beis Yosef and the Magid Avraham and the Mishnah Berurah altogether is like a ruling of the Sanhedrin. And he continues by saying that he couldn't have meant the Mishnah Berurah alone is the Sanhedrin, because the Chazon Ish disagrees with the Mishnah Berurah many times. And then he points out that in his comments to his Tshuvot, Menashe Klein says that the Mishnah Berurah's authority is like a bat kol, a voice from heaven. But he says that when he reprinted this letter in his Mishnah Halachot, he removed that. In any event, the success of the Aruch HaShulchan was limited, and even among Lithuanian Jewry, it never became the standard halachic text. The Chai Yadam was always more popular than the Aruch HaShulchan, and the Aruch HaShulchan is not for the masses, but for the poskim, that became a very important halachic text. Now, there's no question also that the Mishnah Berurah is not as original as the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan comes up with all sorts of new chidushim. It's a more original work, especially when you look in the Rashi script there. That's perhaps what ensured the success of the Mishnah Berurah, that you don't have all these chidushim, which are at odds with other achronim. I think that some people have assumed that. I think, and also some people have assumed what I mentioned already in a previous class, that the Chafetz Chaim, because of his reputation as this great saint, this holy one, that's what made the text really the accepted text. I think both of those reasons probably have something to do with it, but even more important, at least in my mind, is that the Mishnah Berurah kept the Shulchan Aruch as the standard text, the basic text. The Mishnah Berurah is just a commentary on it. The Aruch HaShulchan is an alternative halachic textbook. If the Aruch HaShulchan is to be victorious and to really become the standard halachic text, that means that it's displacing the Shulchan Aruch, because then people will go, they won't, it's when you do the Mishnah Berurah, you study the Shulchan Aruch and then you see the Mishnah Berurah. But if the Aruch HaShulchan is to take the place, then you wouldn't be studying the Shulchan Aruch. You'd be studying the Aruch HaShulchan. And the Shulchan Aruch would just be left for, let's say, post-scheme. It's sort of like when the Rif became the text that they studied in places like Spain, the Talmud was only left for the Talmudic scholars, but not for the average person. And I think that traditional Jewry is not ready now and won't be ready ever. Maybe a couple hundred years ago could have, but it's not ready to relegate the Shulchan Aruch to a secondary position and to bring the Aruch HaShulchan into the new textus receptus, to use the Latin phrase. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan, in order for it to be victorious, would have to become the new text, the basic text, the first text we all go to. And that's something that's not going to happen. The Aruch HaShulchan, its importance, its standing is too much, that the only way to get your ideas accepted anymore, or as part of the curriculum, as part of the corpus, is to use the model of a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And that's pretty much what people do today. There have been exceptions like Shmir Shabbos Kol Chasa, but that's not a code. That's a separate work on Hilchos Shabbos. But still, no one would deny that Shmir Shabbos Kol Chasa has led to a lessening of study of the Mishnah Berurah, because now when you want to know what Hilchos Shabbos is, you go to Shmir Shabbos. But the Aruch HaShulchan would have meant a new code, and that's not where we are. Since the last few hundred years, new codes are not acceptable. What you do is instead you put your commentary on the code that's accepted, the Shulchan Aruch, and that's how you add your opinions. That's at least how I see it. Now, another work of the Aruch HaShulchan is also called Aruch HaShulchan, and that is the Aruch HaShulchan He'atid, the Aruch HaShulchan of the future. Now, I have to say that it's not Aruch HaShulchan Ha'atid, although I was told, maybe someone, David Eisen's listening from Beit Shemesh, I was told some time ago that in modern Hebrew, they no longer do the segel before, the rule is that before a hey and an ayin, where the accent is on the first syllable, then the hey is not ha, but it's he. Chacham, ha'atid, and before a chet, even if it's a single syllable. There's, for some reason, it appears in Tanakh, the word chag, written with a kamas. This is, I think, in Divrei Yomim or Ezra, you can check it. So in Tanakh, they say hechag. And yet, if you look at all the dictionaries, we put it with a patach, so we would say hachag. But I was told that in Israel, and someone can confirm that this is correct, they don't even use the he anymore. So you would say ha'atid, ha'chacham, ha'chasid. But just like we say, I think we still say, maybe not in modern Hebrew, but we do say, we don't say la'atid la'avo, we say le'atid la'avo, because le is it's the hey, it's just been, has been contracted. I have to say that there's a school in Teaneck called Yeshivat He'atid. So this is one of the new schools in Bergen County. So they get it right, but many get it wrong. You can just Google Aruch HaShulchan Ha'atid and you'll see that many get it wrong. This, maybe I should mention this, Pesach, I'm giving a talk at the Pesach program on common mispronunciations in davening. And so maybe I'll mention that as well. Since I see we have some who are from Bergen County area, I can tell you that although Yeshivat Ha'atid gets it right, there's another school that gets it wrong. The girls' school Ma'ayanot. Although again, I don't. Maybe wrong is the wrong word, because in Israel today, it's become right, even though it's wrong. At least if you read it in the Tanakh this way, it's wrong, or Torah. The word Mem Ayin Yud Nun is not pronounced Ma'ayan. There is no patach under the, or even a chatach patach under the ayin. Rather, there is a shva under the ayin, and it's a shva nach. So the word is ma-yan. There's an apostrophe after the ayin. So it's not M-A apostrophe A-Y-A-N or M-A-A-Y-N, although Yehoshua Blau, the great scholar, the one who published the work of the Rambam, the Chuvo, he's a member of the Academy of the Hebrew Language, he wrote an article in the 70s on how, for some reason, modern Hebrew, ma-yan, the correct pronunciation, has turned into ma-yan, and with modern languages, that is also now a correct pronunciation. We know that languages change, and what used to be incorrect is now correct. I can't tell you how often now I see even scholars, when they write, for example, I just showed my wife this before, the word publicly, write it P-U-B-L-I-C-A-L, you know, publicly, A-L-O-Y, A-L-O-Y, after the C, instead of P-U-B-L-I-C-L-Y. So you have all sorts of examples where things become acceptable. But if you're doing Torah learning, and if you're doing, if you're reading from Tanakh, you can't say Ma'ayan. And I'm assuming a school for Torah subjects is using the traditional Torah pronunciation, or it should be. And therefore, my assumption is that when they wrote Ma'ayanot, that they were just wrong, mistaken. So it's Aruch HaShulchan He'atid. It's published posthumously, and it deals with all the laws for the future. Well, not necessarily for the future today, even for the present now, but not the present in his day. So, for example, it deals with the laws of Zera'im, agricultural laws, which today are very practical. In the Aruch HaShulchan's time, we're just starting to become practical. I'll get back to that. Kodshim, of course, Karbanot, still not practical. And Taharot. One of the volumes deals with Nezirut. Nezirut, Nezirus, which also is not really practical. I mean, the Aruch HaShulchan is assuming that in the Messianic days, this will become practical. We'll have more examples of the Nazir. I'm not sure so much why the law of Nazir, for any halakhic reasons, is more for the future, other than the fact you could say you have to bring the carbon afterwards. But I can't imagine we're going to have many Nazirites in the Messianic era either. Those who've been with us a long time know that we had classes on the famous Nazir of Jerusalem. So it's not completely unheard of. Rav Shar Yashav Cohen, chief rabbi of Haifa, passed away a couple years ago. He himself was a Nazir until the age of 16. And any of us listening right now could become a Nazir if you want. Although, well, I should say that neither Rav David Cohen nor Rosh Hashav were halachic nazir in the sense that they took an oath. They just did this. They just acted as a nazir. So I was told by about the nazir about I believe she passed away. Professor Naomi Cohen, did she pass away? I don't want to give an eye on her if she hasn't. Rav Shai Yashav Cohen's wife. Another of the volumes in the Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid, which was published by Mossad Rav Kook, the more recent volume, is not the first one, dealt with Sanhedrin, the laws of the Sanhedrin, Mamrim, these all relate to having a Sanhedrin, Malachim, of course, renewal of the Jewish state, the monarchy, even the Jewish state from the Aruch HaShulchan's perspective is something for the future, Kiddush HaChodesh. The first two volumes on Zroim appear posthumously in 1938, and were published by the grandson of the Aruch HaShulchan, Meir Bar Ilan. It's the grandson because, as we said, that the father of Meir Bar Ilan, the Mizrahi leader, the Nitziv, becomes the son-in-law of the Aruch HaShulchan. Interestingly, and this relates to the question that Moshe from Lakewood asked a few weeks ago about the title, in the introduction to Volume 1 of the Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid, Meir Bar Ilan, his name obviously is Meir Berlin, but he made it, he Zionized it, if that's the term, to Bar Ilan. He says that his grandfather called it this. He says that the Aruch HaShulchan gave it the name Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid, and that's what therefore appears on the title page. However, if you look, the only two volumes published by Meir Bar Ilan were the first two on Zroim. And Yan Zroim. But if you look at the volumes published by Mossad Rav Kook, which were after Meir Aron passed away, volume two of the introduction of volume two, which is in their series, which is the first volume on Kachin, it has the introduction of the Aruch HaShulchan. And I was surprised to see that he calls it the Aruch HaShulchan Le'atid. Not HaAtid. So I have to conclude that this was a mistake on Meir Bar Ilan's part. He probably had known that it was called Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid, but perhaps he didn't have access to the volume on Kachim, or he had looked and then he'd forgotten. But the correct pronunciation for the work should be Aruch HaShulchan Le'atid. It sort of means the same thing in Hebrew, the Aruch HaShulchan for the future, of the future. It basically means the same thing, but we can't change the title now, even though we know what the Aruch HaShulchan would have wanted to call it, because it's already become famous with that. And look, at Mossad Rav Kook, when they published this, and then they published the rest of the volumes, and that's the edition everyone has, they could have changed it, and perhaps they should have changed it to the correct title. However, they didn't, so now we're going to have to live with Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid. Now, in the introduction, he says that these laws I'm going to speak about are Hilchos HaMashicha, laws for messianic days, which he says that we hope that are not too far away. Meir Bar Ilan points out in his introduction that when his grandfather wrote the Aruch HaShulchan, there was no reason to assume, late 19th century, early 20th century, that Jews would soon be living in really great numbers in the land of Israel. And that's why it's for the future. Today, if you'd write a book with these laws, some of them, the laws of Malachim and Kachim, that would be for the future, but the laws of Zeraim would be for the present. Now, in this work, he actually speculates a bit, I found, that this is noted by when Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid appeared, Rav Zevin wrote a nice review of it, and he points out a few very interesting things. And one of them, he shows us that the Aruch HaShulchan actually speculated in a linguistic point. He's dealing with Hilchos Peah, and all these other laws, Leket, Shechacha, all those things. And you have the word, you know, it says, Uferet Karmechel Tokei, you should not gather the fallen fruit of thy vineyard. So then he says, he asks, well, what's this word, parat? You know, where does it come from? You know, what does that, what does that have to do with you know, the agricultural laws that Torah is speaking about? And he says that the word pei resh tet is like the word pei resh dalet, that which we know means separate. And he says because the otiot, this is in Rabbi Zevin in Sofer Musorim volume 2 page 34 notes this. He says that Dalid and Tuf are interchangeable, and so what is Pered Chenifrad Min HaEshkol? That when you know, something falls off from the rest of the fruits there, or he says Prat Uklal. What is Prat? It's what's Nifrad. It's what's separated from the Klal. So that's an interesting philological point that you wouldn't expect by traditional Lithuanian Gadol Yisroel. Rav Zevin also points out something that I mean, we'll talk about it soon enough when we deal with the Aruch Shulchan's approach to Zionism, settlement of the land. But I just mention it because he, the previous page, he mentions this, that the and it's a bit ironic, the Aruch Shulchan was very opposed to the Heter Mechira, selling of land in Israel. It's ironic only because of the great Zionism in the family, but on the other hand, it's not so. I shouldn't say it's ironic, perhaps, because the Netziv was a great Chovei Tzion himself, unlike the Aruch HaShulchan. He too was opposed to Heter Mechira, but the language used by the Aruch HaShulchan is very strong. He says it's a disgrace to the Torah, a disgrace to the land of Israel. The Yad HaMachunim Rak B'Shem Yisrael Be'emsa. He says those people who claim to be, you know, the Jews. Are responsible for this. He's not referring to the Gedolei Yisroel. He's referring to. It's hard to know what he if he knew the situation in the land of Israel, but it's a very, very strange language. I searched on Otzer HaChachma earlier today for those words, and they're even picked up by the Satmar Rebbe, if you can believe it. The Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel, cites this very strong language. Let us move on. Don't think, however, that because the Aruch HaShulchan spoke against the Heter Mechira that he wasn't concerned with the land of Israel anymore, as I said, than the Netziv. He was concerned with the economy of Eretz Yisrael. In the 1890s, he was one of the people who were adamant that no one should buy an esrog from Corfu. When this is a whole sugya, I published something myself on it of esroge Corfu. And when this summer, everyone is cordially invited to come to Greece with us. We go to Corfu. Corfu has a long history, a long Jewish history, and there's a lot to talk about, Gedolei Yisrael and all sorts of interesting things. And one of the things I speak about is the famous controversy over the Esrogim of Corfu, which, believe it or not, there were never any ever Esrogim made grown in Corfu. So why are they called Esroge Corfu? Because when they were harvested in the other towns, they were brought to Corfu, and from there they were shipped to where they were shipped to, and they were under the hashgacha of the rabbi of Corfu. But people don't realize that they never were actually in Corfu. But so you had these esrogim, though they were coming from Greece, and to this day some Hasidim are attached to these esrogim from Italy. I don't know if anyone's still from Greece, but there were people in those days, Hasidim, who liked the ones from Greece, and the Aruch HaShulchan is very strong that we have to support Eretz Yisrael. And there it's different because you were supporting you have a choice of supporting Jewish farmers in Eretz Yisrael or supporting the non-Jews. I know that Chabad and maybe other Hasidim have this whole thing, you know, that there's something special about the esrogim they get from Italy, Calabria, I think it is, and Yanava, the other esrogim, Yanava is Genoa in Italy, and therefore if Shneur Zalman used it and all the rest of them, we have to continue using it. But most people don't assume that if it's a kosher esrog, you go and you support the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. And that was the common thing also, especially after there was anti-Semitic persecution that happened in Greece as a way of punishing the anti-Semites. There was a cherem even declared against buying the esrogim there. I bought the esrogim every single year from Eretz Yisrael, except for 1 year or 2 years. But I don't think I violated any, not just any cherem or any Zionist thing, because there's, believe it or not, there's an Esrog farm by a Jewish guy in Dallas. You can Google it, Zadie's Esrog Farm. And he has a Esrogim there. So one year I decided I should try to support, if there's one guy in it, as far as I know, there's only one Jewish guy in America growing Esrogim for sale, and that's Zadie's Esrog Farm. So I got a very nice Esrog from him. Furthermore, on at least one occasion, he gave money to Chovei Tzion to support settlement in the land of Israel. This information, which I just gave you, which I'll give you more about as well, comes from another article by Eitam Henkin, which is included in the book that was published recently. It's unusual that he would give money to Chovei Tzion, perhaps because he was not a supporter of Chovei Tzion, as we'll see. He was not a supporter of proto-Zionism. He's not like the Netziv. Henkin doesn't really go into this. He just mentions that he gave it and the occasion, but I think it's worth noting that the occasion of him donating money to Chovei Tzion was in honor of the wedding of Rav Yaakov Berlin, who was the other son of the Netziv. I think that explains why he gave the money, because the Netziv was such a strong supporter of Chovei Tzion that it makes sense that even if it's not his tzedakah, and he didn't even agree with it, in honor of the wedding of the Netziv's son, that's a good tzedakah. For all we know, this was reported in one of the newspapers he gave. For all we know, like today, when there's someone people send out saying, in lieu of gifts, donate, let's say, donate to the Jewish National Fund, you could say. It could be that that's exactly what the Netziv said, in lieu of gifts, or consider donating, and that's why he donated it. Now, why, though, was the Aruch HaShulchan not a supporter of Chovei Tzion? We're not dealing with political Zionism here. There's many Gedolim who support Chovei Tzion in Lithuania. I'm not talking about Hungary, but in Lithuania and Poland. And then when political Zionism came in, so then many of them abandoned it. But what's wrong with Chovei Tzion? Henkin assumes, it's Eitam Henkin, that the reason why the Aruch HaShulchan was lukewarm to even in opposition to Chovei Tzion was for the same reason as so many, that there were many non. It got to the point, we're not dealing with the era of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, we're dealing with a later era, that there were many non-religious involved in the leadership of Chovei Tzion. Remember Hirsch, if we recall, why did Shimshon Raphael Hirsch opposed Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, opposed early Chovei Tzion, because he had the Satmar perspective that we have to remain in the Galut until God brings us back. The Hungarians also opposed it because they had this notion that we can't move to the land of Israel en masse until God wants us to. Certainly, you can't go there to start farming. If you go to Israel, you have to live like someone supported by one of the Kohanim. But that's not the Lithuanian or Polish perspective, which is why many rabbis supported it. However, with the influx of the non-religious into positions of authority, that's what Henkin says. That's the reason. There is also, however, a report by the Aderis, Rav Kook's father-in-law, Eliyahu Dover Rabinitz Teumim, that the Aruch HaShulchan thought that the focus of settlement of the land, that is encouraging people to move there, was opposed to his conception that the redemption would not be b'derech hateva, would not be by going to the land and settling it, and then that'll lead into the redemption, but it'll be completely messianic. It's hard to know what to really make of that because, what do you mean? B'derech, so what? So what if the messianic era is going to be not b'derech teva? What does it have to do with going to the land? Going to the land is still living in the land of Israel. It still gives you a chance to fulfill the mitzvot. It's better to live in the land of Israel than to live in Chutz Laaretz. Many of the supporters of Chovei Tzion did not see what they were doing at all messianic. It was simply about that Eretz Israel was the natural place for Jews. You can do more mitzvot there. We won't be living in a goyish environment. Nothing messianic at all. So, I mean, the comment that the Aderet reports in the name of the Aruch HaShulchan would imply that the Aruch HaShulchan actually held of a position similar to maybe Hirsch and the Satmar, that we have to wait in Chutz Laaretz until God brings us back. But that's contradicted by everything else we know about the Aruch HaShulchan and his perspective on this, that I don't feel we can give it really much weight. And I think we should assume, like Henkin, that the issue with the Aruch HaShulchan is simply it's that it's non-religious involvement. Now, the Rav Henkin, I mean, Eitam Henkin quotes a letter of the Nitziv, where the Nitziv explains why, in contrast, let's say, to the Aruch HaShulchan, he felt that it was okay, not just okay, but was appropriate and proper for him to be involved in Chovei Tzion, even though you now had non-religious involved. I don't even know technically if I should be using the term Chovei Tzion. Sometimes people like to use the term Chovei Tzion really before the non-religious get involved, but I don't think that's accurate. I mean, I think we usually distinguish between the rise of political Zionism with Herzl and everything prior to that we call Chovei Tzion, and there were plenty of non-religious involved in. But the Nitziv, who maybe the next classes will be on the Nitziv. Rabbi Kelman, you know, wants me, he's going to be asking me when we're done next week, what's next? So obviously the Nitziv is a very significant figure. But listen to what the Nitziv says in explaining why he, and you can find this in a number of places, most convenient is Henkin's article on a topic which is in Hamayan, also Hamayan, not Hamayan, volume 57, Nisan, Tufshin, Ayin, Zion. He says, I know that there are, page 65, he says, I know that there are people who are not religious, and there's Gedolius, and there are people who oppose this, including Gedol Yisrael. But he says that there's a reason why I'm involved. He says I know all this, and I'm attentive to what they say. Nevertheless, Chashavti ki tov lasot mitzvah shelo kahogen mishelo lasot klal. He says it's better to do a mitzvah, namely settlement in the land of Israel, not in the best way, that is involved with the non-religious, have some involvement, than not to do it at all. And then he quotes a Gemara that says, you know, that supports his idea. And then, therefore, when the people asked me to become a Gabbai of Chovei Tzion, I said yes. And he says, because I thought also that maybe I'd be able with a Kain Benyan to correct matters. And now that, you know, I'm sitting together with two Gaonim who are Gabayim, I forget which ones these other Rabbanim were that he was with. If I can't fix it, then I could say, you know, we're not going to have anything to do with it. But as long as he have a chance to fix it and make it better, he says, I'm going to get involved. And furthermore, if you can do a mitzvah, even if it's not the best way, better to do it that way than to not do it at all. But the Aruch HaShulchan had a different perspective. In 1904, the Aruch HaShulchan publishes a letter, not only against Zionism, but against Mizrahi. He attacks the new Mizrahi movement, which was just founded in 1904. It's founded in Pressburg, Bratislava. Going to Bratislava this summer, Pressburg, invite everyone to come. When the Mizrahi was founded, the Rav of Pressburg, the Shevet Sofer, he left. He went away for Shabbos. So as that he, the whole time when they were there, so he, because if he remained there, he'd have to you know, show kavod and go meet all the Mizrahi Rabbanim, because there were big Rabbanim. And he didn't want to be put in this situation, so instead he made himself absent. He absent from there, so I wouldn't be forced to take, you know, a stand on this matter. Sort of like getting back to the Ilhan Omar stuff I spoke about, that when they have the vote that apparently will be tomorrow about her, you'll see how many people are absent, and because they don't want to come out against her because they don't want to get the wrath of the younger progressives. Now, this letter of the Aruch HaShulchan appeared in Hapelis. Hapelis was a rabbinic journal that appeared for a few years, published by the Rav of Poltava. His name was Eliyahu Akiva Rabinowitz. He later publishes the newspaper. The Hapelis comes out at the turn of the 20th century. Then Rav Cook's first writing, one of his first writings, some of his most important early writing, appear in Hapelis. Then he publishes Hamodia, which appears from around 1909 to 1913. That's the newspaper of the rabbinic elite in Russia. The name Hamodia, which was taken by the Aguda for their newspaper when it was founded, was taken precisely because they saw themselves as a continuation of this yeshiva world newspaper, this anti-Zionist newspaper. The difference being that when Hamodia appeared in Russia, it was only a, you know, the masses don't read Hebrew. They only read Yiddish. So this was for the rabbinic elite. The Hamodia in Israel is in Hebrew, where all the masses read Hebrew. This Eliyahu Akiva Rabinowitz, however, was one of the big backers of Chovei Tzion. But once political Zionism is founded, well, he even remained part of it when political Zionism was founded. It was only when the fateful decision was made to include cultural activities in Zionism, and these cultural activities, you know, could be non-religious because the leaders were not religious, that's when he, and not just him, Reb Yehuda Leib Tzurelson and others leave the Zionist movement and say, we cannot be part of a movement if they're also going to include culture, namely heretical stuff, as part of what Zionism is. If they keep it just political, the idea of just trying to get an Eretz Yisrael, then we're full in. But when they try to also add cultural elements to it, and we have nothing to do with them, we can't remain part of them. The Mizrahi movement, however, said, nevertheless, we will remain and we'll fight from the inside. And this therefore led the people to, who broke with the Zionist movement, like Rabinowitz and others, not just to become very anti-Zionist, but also to become anti-Mizrahi. When you say anti-Zionist, not because they had any conception that we shouldn't go back to the land of Israel, but anti-Zionist in the sense that the people who are currently leading the movement and the ones who are going to achieve this victory, they're the ones we have to be opposed to. If we could overthrow them and make it religious Zionism, then they'd be very happy, or they even would be happy if they can go back to the old way. So that, and he becomes a leading ideologue. So it's no accident that the letter of the Aruch HaShulchan appears in HaPeles. What Rav Kook is doing writing for HaPeles, well, that's part of the whole story. You know, the idea being that he was trying to bring his ideas to the rabbinic elite to try to change their positions. And in any event, a number of his ideas in HaPeles, he changes them later. Let's see, Yehuda Kook famously said that the articles in HaPeles, you know, that's Torah's Chutz La'aretz. That's the Torah of Chutz La'aretz, which is superseded by Orot and the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. Furthermore, Ritz Yehuda Kook said that he suspected that there was some forgery, that is some additional stuff added on to Rav Kook's articles in HaPeles, because he says some things there which really don't reflect his views later on about the non-religious, but that Ritz Yehuda is definitely wrong on this. How could, he's not saying my father told me this. This article was published in Rav Kook's lifetime. Rav Kook is in Russia when it's published. Had Rabinowitz taken liberties and altered passages of it, obviously Rav Kook would have mentioned something about it. He never did. And you're going to tell me the Ritz Yehuda is going to say, well, because what he says in HaPeles is so different than what he said later on. Yes, he changed his mind. He changed his mind on a lot of things. Not surprisingly, Yehuda Leib Maimon claimed that the Aruch HaShulchan told him that he very much regretted writing this anti-Zionist letter. Again, I'll say that we can't believe Maimon. Maimon, who's a super Zionist, a Mizrahi leader together with Bar Ilan, we can't believe everything he says about the Aruch HaShulchan and Zionism, and let's just leave it at that. However, we also can't forget that Maimon was a close student of the Aruch HaShulchan. He received Simicha from him at the very time that Maimon was very involved in his Zionist activities. He was not only a student at Aruch HaShulchan, he was learning in the Aruch HaShulchan's house. Maimon even claims that Mayor Bar Ilan's whole attachment to Zionism comes through him, that it was Yehuda Leib Maimon who turned Mayor Bar Ilan onto Zionism when he was a student of the Aruch HaShulchan. And Maimon acknowledges that the Aruch HaShulchan opposed Zionism, but he wants to portray him as someone who is not a zealot. And he says, well, the Aruch HaShulchan told him he was pressured into condemning it. And maybe that's correct, but I just can't take his word for it, knowing where he comes from. But Maimon never says that the Aruch HaShulchan is a Zionist. And the fact, as I mentioned, that the Aruch HaShulchan, even though he was an anti-Zionist, that at the same time that he was saying anti-Zionist things, Rabbi Maimon was a Talmud Mufak of his and was engaged in Zionism, shows that the Aruch HaShulchan was not a zealot. He had his position. At the same time, he could have a student who was publicly involved in Zionist activities. He tells us that the Aruch HaShulchan was not pleased with his Zionist activities. And the Aruch HaShulchan told him that it's a problem for you to be involved in all this Zionism because everyone knows that I'm not a Zionist. But he still remained a student and received smicha from him. Okay, oh, I see it's already 9:56. So let me just make one more comment, then I'll end and I'll take questions. Only because we've been speaking so much about the Aruch HaShulchan, let me just end, and I'll make a mark for this, about the Aruch HaShulchan, and then we'll pick up with his next class with his other writings, and then we'll return to the Aruch HaShulchan to see some of his interesting halachic rulings. I've been calling it Aruch HaShulchan. As far as I know, everyone calls it Aruch HaShulchan. Yet there's a rabbi in Israel. His name is Rabbi Mordechai Rabinovich. Rabbi Mordechai Rabinovich is the son-in-law of Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Rosh Shiva Mali Adumim. Today, I think you have to regard as the leading religious Zionist Rosh Hashiva in the world. And together with Rav Yaakov Ariel, I would say the greatest posek in the religious Zionist community. Even if his psak on using key cards on Shabbat in a hotel has not yet caught on, he still is with Rav Ariel, the great posek. He studies in Baltimore, in Toronto. He's rabbi in Dallas, he's rabbi in Charleston, and back in Toronto, and then he goes to Jews College. I just was reading over Shabbos this new book by Derek Taylor about Jews College, which was an important institution in England for a long time, and then he goes to Israel, Mali Adrumim. Well, he has a son, who's also Talmud Chacham. And Nachum Rabinovich wrote the Yad Peshuta, which is a multi-volume commentary on the Rambam. Alan Nadler was a student of his for a time and wrote in Tablet. A while back on Nachum Rabinovich. I highly recommend everyone reading that. Well, he has a son, Rav Mordechai Rabinovich, who is a big Talmud Chacham. Not only that, he is a Chavrusa with, I mentioned this already, Rav Shlomo Fischer, one of the great Gaonim of our day. He published this volume that I referred to last class on the Aruch HaShulchan, dealing with, it's a commentary on the Aruch HaShulchan. Well, he has two volumes, and he vocalizes, or to use the art scroll term, vowelizes the word, he puts the nekudot in, as Aruch HaShulchan. That was his big chiddush. That actually should be not Aruch HaShulchan, Aruch HaShulchan, because these very words, with this vocalization, appear in Yeshayahu chapter 21, verse 5. And we always assume that that's how you pronounce words, based on how they appear in Tanakh. I thought of this on Shabbos because we read in the Torah, there's a Sefer, Kafter Vaferach. Kafter Vaferach, correct? No, it's Kafter Vaferach. The people who were reading Torah will let me know. But we saw it in the, it appears one time in Shabbos, as I think they said Kafter Vafarech. So you wouldn't, we don't call it by its end, by the end of the Pasuk. We call it the way it normally should be. That's why I made the claim that it shouldn't be Evan HaAzel, it should be Evan HaEzel. But usually, based on how it appears in Tanakh, that's how it should be the title. But in this case, it's incorrect. There's no question it's incorrect. Why do I say that? Well, when the work was published, and this is pointed out by our Eitam Henkin, not in reference to Mordechai Rabinovich, just in discussing the history of the book, the work was published by Rav Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan himself, and the title in Russian appears on the binding. And Rav Epstein knew Russian very well, and the Russian reads Aruch. Now, Henkin also notes that in the edition published in Vilna by his daughter, and I did a post on this, and I put this text on the screen. It has, in addition to the Hebrew, it also has on the second page there in Russian. And in, it writes out the title in Russian. And the title there is written again, Aruch. No, sorry, let me take that back. When the Aruch HaShulchan published it, had the title in Russian, and he knew Russian well as Aruch. And when the daughter published it, she published the title in Latin characters, I guess you'd say in Polish or whatever, but in Latin characters. And once again, we see that it was pronounced Aruch. So it's a nice and ingenious suggestion by Mordechai Rabinovich, but it's not true. So why you're saying, so why is it our Aruch HaShulchan if the pasuk says Aruch HaShulchan? Because it's obviously it's a play. It's a play on the words. You have Shulchan Aruch, so now you have Aruch HaShulchan. It has nothing to do with the verse in Yeshayahu. Let us it's in Yecheskel. What's in Yecheskel, Moshe? Write it out. Okay, let me go back. Questions here. Questions and comments. Baruch says, no modern Orthodox have Gullit mentality anymore to acknowledge the country's Malkut Shel Chesed. As far as I know, but there's a lot of modern Orthodox people listening to us, I don't know anyone who would speak in terms. I've never heard a modern Orthodox rabbi or modern Orthodox writer refer to America as a Malkut Shel Chesed. Malkut Shel Chesed implies that you're sort of like not a citizen. You're like a subject, and the country is being nice to you. All the modern Orthodox people I know assume that we're part of the country. And that's, as I mentioned, of Schefter's whole point about taxes, that you know, it's our money. We're part of it. And therefore, that's why you don't, there's no notion of cheating on taxes and anything like might have applied in earlier times. So do I say that no modern Orthodox use it? I'm sure, of course, you'll probably have some, but it's not something, having lived my entire life in this community, the whole notion of calling America a Malchus Shel Chesed goes against the whole grain that it's not a Malchus, it's a democracy where everyone's involved. Moshe says his other Sfarim, like Alino Shabbat, have plenty of stories of dubious reliability. Only a fool would believe them. That's referring to Silberstein. But I don't think, Moshe, that Silberstein wants you to believe them. I think he's telling stories like you might have any other sort of stories that are told, tales, Aesop's fables. The whole point of the story, I think, is to put forward lessons and all that. Basically, he's creating like a modern Aesop's fables, or modern, almost modern Midrash even. He certainly can't believe these stories are true. And the point is the lessons they derive. Someone has to know him listening to us. And he gives a shiur to doctors. I know a doctor who goes to a shiur. I mean, I would like someone at least to ask him, but I think it's obvious that he comes out with a new book or two books every single year, a new book with the craziest stories that are just impossible. And the problem is that some of the stories deal with Rabbanim. And there's one case someone showed me. He was very disturbed because he quotes, supposedly he's quoting from a biography on the Nun Behuda, this biography that was published by Mosada Rav Kook. I forget the author now. He was an American Zionist who went on Aliyah. I forget the name of the author. And he quotes it, but he adds in his own material. That is, he says he's quoting it, and he puts like in quotation marks, but he quotes it, but then he adds in more stuff, which is not in the text. And I checked all three editions of it. They're all the same. So he feels that, for whatever reason, he feels that he can take liberty with texts. He feels he can make up stories. I don't know what to make of it. Baruch says, let me suggest that the Aruch HaShulchan be viewed in the context of Russian history, vis-a-vis different periods of the Tsarist regime and different Tsars compared to Ivan the Terrible and other extreme leaders. During the time of the Aruch HaShulchan, the leaders were more moderate, at least some of them. Some of them were somewhat modernizing and somewhat liberal for Russia. You're absolutely correct, Baruch. But even if you would go back further with harsher Tsars, there still was a notion when they prayed for the Tsar, it was an honest praying that the Tsar should be kept, he should do justly with us. And even though they didn't like everything the Tsar did, there was always a sense that the Tsar is better than the masses. Look at the Khmelnytsky pogroms. There was always a fear of the masses, that the Tsars, for however bad the Tsars are, the Tsars will at least keep the masses at bay. And you had this in Germany as well. Wherever you had rulers, either church rulers or royal rulers, the Jews were regarded as property of the ruler and were protected. However, in the cities, the independent cities, Jews had no protection. That's why they were thrown at them and they didn't live there. So I think it is honest when you read, when they say we have to be loyal to the Tsar, that's an honest statement. It's not just an honest statement Because if we're not loyal, the Tsar will kill us. It's an honest statement because we're supposed to be loyal because God wants us to be loyal. He wants us to be loyal to the Babylonians. He wants us to be loyal to all the leaders because that's the only way that Judaism can function. With a strong leader who sees that we're good citizens will protect us. In the days of the Tsar, it was incomprehensible of something like we live today that we'd be treated as equals. They always assumed that they'd be oppressed. The question was just how much would they be oppressed? And hopefully it wouldn't be too much. The Ramah states explicitly in Choshen Mishpat that even if the Jews are oppressed, this does not void the law of Dina D'Malchus HaDina. You still need to pay taxes even if you are taxed higher than the non-Jews. Of course, that reaches a point where there's too much taxation and it's called thievery. But the idea that it shows the difference between us and previous generations. I think in America today, let's say the government passed laws, anti-Semitic laws, that quotas against Jews, something like that, we all of a sudden would say that we have no loyalty to this government. It's Dina D'Malchus doesn't apply. And yet that Rav Lichtenstein once pointed out that this is completely incorrect. Until the United States was formed, every government in history was anti-Semitic. It was part of their nature. They're basic. They were all anti-Semitic. And no one ever said that. I mean, these laws were developed under Roman rule, under Babylonian rule. These were terribly anti-Semitic governments. No one ever said that there's no law of Dina D'Malchus if the government is anti-Semitic. The government, by definition, were anti-Semitic, and yet they said Dina D'Malchus HaDina. Moshe from Lakewood says there's a rabbi there, won't say his name, that always reads stories from him. You always have a good laugh. All I would say, Moshe, is it depends what the point of the story is. In his halachic writings, not his book, Aleinu L'Shaveach, in the halachic works, in his Talmudic works, I should say, the stories, the crazy stories, are just to set the stage, like a theoretical case, to then go into the very interesting halachic principles. Much like when you used to graduate from rabbinical seminary in Berlin, they would give you a case, and you would have to write a tshuva on it. It's true, in the other works, the stories are not really just halachic, but I still think they're there for, I guess, lessons. If you take these stories seriously, then you're being very naive and not sophisticated. But we have lots of rabbis who tell stories like that and lots of books like that. The novelty is that what everyone finds so incredible is Rav Zilberstein is a posek muvak, and he's a bucky and shas and posky of an enormous level. And yet he himself is doing something. When's the last, like this, when's the last time you had a Lithuanian Godel B'Torah who spends his time with phony stories like this? It is strange. Almost like the Torah Tamima, perhaps. Baruch says, if the modern Orthodox don't like the term Malchus Shel Chesed, they should say Medina Shel Chesed. Okay, I guess you could say Medina Shel Chesed. All Medina Shel Chesed means it's a nothing wrong, nothing against Medina Shel Chesed. But I don't think they feel they need to say it to constantly say it. If you live in America, you appreciate it. It's the modern Orthodox who eat turkey on Thanksgiving, let's not forget. Moshe says, I don't think I've ever seen the Chazon Ish discuss the Aruch Shulchan, and I'm wrong. I can't say that I'm a bucky in the Chazon Ish at all. So I've never seen a reference in the Chazon Ish to it, so I don't know. It could be that's a sign that he didn't hold of him. Rav Kahaneman of the Ponevez Yeshiva, who was very close to the Chazon Ish, did not hold of him. There's a letter. If you look in Rav Yitzhak Ratzabi, he's a Yemenite posek, he has a letter to me in his tshuvot, Olat Yitzchak, dealing with, because I wrote to him, pointing, he writes how we don't accept the Aruch Shulchan, and I wrote to him, and I said, who says we don't accept the Aruch Shulchan? And I quoted Rav Henkin, etc., and I said, basically I said to him, you've been hanging around Hungarians, not with the Lishusha world. And he wrote back saying that, yes, he knows about Rav Moshe, etc., but what he says, Dafka comes from the Lithuanian world, and he quotes Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the part of the yeshiva, who said that we prefer the Mishnah Berurah. So it's not clear that in the Lithuanian world, it's only the Aruch Shulchan. Moshe says there's a story that the Chidushi Harim of Gur wrote a commentary in the Choshen Mishpat, and the Kutzker told him to burn it, lest it supersede the Shach. So some people are loath to replace even commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. And yes, we have other examples of that. David Eisen, who's in Israel, says, as far as he knows, the Segel is still used. I'm happy to hear that. What I'll just add, though, David, I was with Pesach a couple of years ago at a different hotel, and I spoke about pronunciation, and I spoke about the Patach Genuvah, the furtive Patach, the word Aleph Lamed Vav Hey, as pronounced Eloah, not Eloha. And there was an Israeli there, not an American living in Israel, an actual Israeli, and he had never heard of that. And he wasn't sure whether he should believe me. I mean, he knew that you pronounce Nun Chaf and Kaf Chaf as Noach and Koach, but he never heard of this notion that the hay at the end with the dagesh in it and the patach is pronounced gavoa, eloa, etc. So that seemed to me not so common. Again, I don't know how often they use those words in modern Hebrew. Moshe says Yanover. Yanover comes from Genoa. So there's an article about the American Astro Game. I'll have to see it. Oh, that's about the guy from Dallas. Baruch says the Dallas guy doesn't grow them. No, I was told he grows them. He has his own farm. He might grow them somewhere else as well, but when I bought it about 10 years ago, I was told, not by him, but I was told by someone from that area that he grows them. Maybe not anymore. What happened to his response? Next class, I believe, will be the last class. Baruch says Rizul is not Lithuanian. You're right, he's not Lithuanian, but I regard him as Lithuanian because he's part of the Lithuanian Torah world. He married into the Lithuanian elite. Okay, I'll accept that. You're right. So he carries in his non-Lithuanian into it. I accept that. So he's not really Lithuanian. But I don't know, you know, when you spend your whole life in the Litvish Torah world, doesn't that sort of convert you? Okay, everyone, good night, and God willing, we'll meet again next week.